When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by two of my favorite people from The Ankler. We've got Richard Rushfield, of course, first time, the first guest ever on The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood returns
Once again, we could say the first guest and the last guest, if it were
potentially, first and last. You know, it's going to be disappointing if this wraps
until
up
next.
Before one more guest, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Katie Rich, who is the awards editor at The Ankler. We have exciting stuff to talk about with The Ankler pundits.
Yeah.
You guys have built a nice little engine to create some sort of Oscar prediction shenanigans. I'm glad to take part in this. We can discuss all that.
Yeah, Sonny, I'm looking at your predictions right now, and I'll let you know how wrong you are whenever you tell me.
That's fair. I tweaked them a little bit after the Golden Globes because I am more confident now about Demi Moore among others. But we'll get to that in a second. First, I just want to talk to Richard about how things are in Los Angeles, because we're going to be talking about award season, and you know, there's going to be an effort to kind of downplay that and say, well, should we be talking about this in the midst of all this tragedy? I think we should for several reasons, but one of them. Before we get to that, though, I just want to talk to Richard about how things are in his neighborhood, in his neck of the woods, because you're in Los Angeles proper, right, Richard? I mean, where are you? How do things look around you?
So I'm in Westwood, which is like two neighborhoods over from where the fire is. The Palisades, where it's which has been the hardest hit here, is where I grew up. And in fact, it seemed like the fire started about two blocks from my childhood house and everything. So we've seen, I've stopped counting the number of friends that have lost their houses in the past couple days. I think about 15 was where I stopped counting. And my elementary school is gone. My junior high school is gone. The town I grew up. So it's pretty, you don't get this, like the whole section of the city just wiped out. Like, we always have fires here. Part of life in LA, but it's usually like, you know, a dozen homes are destroyed in some area, and maybe you know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. You don't get like a section of the city demolished.
Yeah, I mean, it's really it's devastating to look at. I mean, it looks like the aftermath of some sort of bombing campaign. I mean, it's crazy. How are folks holding up? I mean, are you out and about? What's the general mood?
Pretty grim and freaked out. It's they're grim about what's happened, grim about where it's going, that, you know, they're constantly warning us, 36 hours, the winds are going to pick up again. So be ready for it. And, yesterday, there was a point where it was feeling like it could sweep over into Santa Monica, which would be a whole another level of destruction. Grim and nervous, I would say, is the tone right now. And and anger towards some parties beginning to build.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we are thinking about you. I don't want to dwell on this too much because lots of people are talking about this, but it's very grim, and I hope you guys pull through okay, because
thank you,
it's
yeah.
just a nightmare. Let's shift gears slightly and talk about the Golden Globes. So the Golden Globes happened last weekend. It feels like a million years ago now at this point. But there are things to discuss here. Amongst them, Richard, you've written about the, you know, kind of weird double dealing, self dealing of the Globes and their, you know, the way the Penske folks have, you know, kind of integrated themselves into all that. But the awards show itself is still kind of fun, is still entertaining. Katie, were you there? Were you actually at the show?
Because of Richard, partly, I think. They declined to offer me a seat at the Golden Globes.
I ruined her.
Oh, that's too
there
bad.
There is for press, they always put the press at a table in the way, way, way far back. Like, I went to the Netflix after party after the Globes and ran into friends who had been there, and they showed me a picture from their seat where you basically had to, like, stand up to see the stage.
Yeah, but only fools stay at their table.
Like, oh, that's true. So. But, like, it is a, I think, a symbolic representation of how much you're going to get out of actually being there in person. Yeah. I mean, Richard and I, we can talk about this, I think, have some disagreement about how much the Globes matter in the grand scheme of things. But I don't feel like I miss a ton by not being there. But I certainly watch them.
Yeah. So what was your big takeaway from the Globes? Because I know there is a lot of talk about, like, well, the Globes, you know, the voters for the Globes, they're not part of the guilds. They're not part of the Academy. Can you really translate what they do to Oscar prediction? And I'm open to that. But I do think that, as I mentioned, Demi Moore moved up on my chart because it became very obvious. Her speech was so good and so compelling. And the role itself is actually also very good and very, very compelling. The work she did was very good and very compelling, that it seems obvious that she has, at the very least, talked her way into an Oscar nomination, which I don't think was 100% sure before this, but probably.
No, I think she's the prime example of something the Globes can often do, which is where someone wins, gives a really good speech. You see them standing on stage holding a trophy and you think, oh, this makes sense. Like, everything locked into place. And the Best Actress race this year has felt so competitive. There's, I think, 15 performances that could have reasonably made a shot at getting an Oscar nomination. And it's been really hard to kind of see who would shake out in all of that. And I was the same way as you, where I was like, oh, to me more, maybe she'll get a nomination. The Substance is popular, but it's pretty weird. And then the minute she started giving that speech, she said, oh, it's the Brendan Fraser moment. It's Jamie Lee Curtis. It's everyone who's had, like, a comeback narrative. She's going to get that nomination. I think she's going to win at this point. And there's other smaller examples of that happen at the Globes. But I think even though the people who vote on the Globes aren't in the Academy, they're not anything, you know, there's no overlap there at all. They're a large group. They're a lot bigger than they used to be. It's like 300 people. It shows you how a consensus vote can go, like who might be popular enough to make it through from, like, a relatively large group of people, and then gives you a sense of who can meet at the moment, who gets received well in the room, who everyone wants to talk to in the room. It's a big indicator, more than something that kind of tells you how the Oscars themselves are going to vote.
Yeah, the increased size of the group, the voting body, in addition to the change in kind of how that voting group, you know, it used to be they were foreign correspondents who were in L.A. mostly, I think.
Lived in Los Angeles was the qualification.
Yeah.
Right. But now they're kind of all over. Right. So my point being that it does feel like the body is larger, and you would think would go for kind of a more general thing. But it also felt like the awards this year were pretty well received by critics. Like, a lot of the times critics will be like, Golden Globes, who are these people winning? Why is this happening? It felt like it was pretty well received this year, right, Katie?
Yeah, no, it used to be something where, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press, as they used to be called, were notorious for if you flew them to a nice location or threw a nice enough dinner for them, they would vote for your movie. It kind of felt like an easily swayed and, again, smaller group. But now they behave more like a critics group. Like, I think the well, the Critics' Choice Awards have been postponed. We can talk about that. I think that some of the winners would have repeated at Critics' Choice. And maybe some of them wouldn't have, but they just, you know, they go with something that's a little bit more acclaimed, like Sebastian Stan winning for A Different Man. That is not something the Golden Globes would have done 10 years ago. So I think, again, in my arguments with Richard about why we need to give them credit, they make good choices. They give statues to people who might not get any further in this award season, and I'm grateful for it.
Now, Richard, things have changed. This is, it is, because it is larger, it is a slightly less weird, eclectic mix. You know, I think in one of your newsletters you said, you know, being in LA, being an actual community of people led to, you know, a certain sensibility and idea of what a Golden Globe movie is. And that has changed, right?
I mean, it was a cohesive group that there were 80 of them. You saw them out at events. If you want to know what was influencing them or how their process worked, you could walk up to one of them and ask them, and they were happy to talk your ear off about it, and they talked to each other, and you sort of got us. It was an actual group that had a reason for existing and a reason for being there and some sense to it. And now it is 300 foreigners that the owners of the show say are involved in journalism to some extent or another. You can look at their bios on the site there and wonder about what that extent is. We don't know. Do they ever speak to each other? Do they discuss? Do they debate? They don't go to screenings together because they're scattered across the planet or anything. So there doesn't seem to be anything other than they send a ballot to 300 foreigners. And this is what 300 foreigners said. So, You know, a random poll of 300 people that don't live in America. So
I mean, it's more or less how Critics' Choice works, too, where it's 300 people who,
Are you putting up Critics' Choice as the example?
Well, I'm in Critics' Choice. Maybe I'm overly biased. But I don't know. That feels like not an outrageous way to go about doing it, and less prime for, you know, thinking in a bubble and thinking we loved Angelina Jolie when she met us for dinner that time, so we're going to give her a nomination for The Tourist, you know?
The comparison to the Critics' Choice Award is interesting because it does feel to a certain extent like what the Golden Globes has done is created this sort of large critical body that has more sway with the rest of the awards season than any of the individual critical groups had before that, right? Do you understand what I'm saying making sense? Is it because it does feel like a different sort of thing? The awards feel different. They feel, you know, still kind of, it's still the Golden Globe, so like whatever. But also, it did feel like a more representative reflection of not only critical taste, but also like where critical taste intersects with awards possibility, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they're more important than the Critics' Choice Awards, certainly. I mean, I would say that the New York and Los Angeles film critics groups have their own version of influence. You know, a couple of years ago, they gave, both of them maybe gave Best Picture to Drive My Car, you know, the Japanese film that not a lot of people had seen, and kind of launched it into an Oscar campaign, got it a Best Picture nomination. It's not quite the same as like Demi Moore giving one speech and winning an Oscar because of it, but there is influence among them. But the Golden Globes are just kind of stuck in the spot of the thing that everybody actually watches, you know, everybody being 10.1 million people, like not a ton of people. But I am with Richard in that I think they have an outsized amount of importance. I don't know that this is the group that's worthy of it, but they do. And, you know, if we're going to be stuck with them in this spot, they may as well give it to good people, which they did this year.
So I will just point out that we're talking about their good choices, you know, this is a group of 300 people. We don't know who they are. We don't know how they vote. We don't know what kind of influence on them. We just have to trust their owners, Jay Penske and Todd Boehly, that it's all above board. We don't know anything about them. They're not available to be talked with. And the two big awards, one of them went to a film from a company owned by Todd Boehly, one of the owners of Golden Globes, and the other one went to a company that they very much hope to be in business with, Netflix, and have got a great plates to make happy. So, you know, all I'm yeah. sure it was all just fine, but it worked out very. If you wanted to say what would be the best outcome for the Globes in advance, you would have said for those two movies to win. And
yeah. Well, let's all right. So let's dig into this, because what Richard is hinting at here. One of the awards was given to The Brutalist, which was distributed by A24. The Brutalist is A24's, I think, biggest awards contender this year in several major categories. The other, of course, is Wicked, and or, I'm sorry, not Wicked. Amelia Perez,
notably not Wicked.
Notably not Wicked. Yeah. Notably not Amelia Perez, which is at Netflix. And I like that's the one where I'm like, is that where the Oscars are headed towards Amelia Perez and not Wicked? Because I would be surprised, but we could discuss that. The Brutalist in A24 and the Penske and the Bowley of it all is kind of the interesting, fascinating bundle of conflicts and
the hotel. They also own the hotel.
All right, Richard, just run through the whole list for us of the Penske conflict tree that we've got here.
So the Golden Globes are now owned by Dick Clark Productions, the co-presentation. These two billionaires form a joint venture to control it all. Todd Bowley, who additionally owned Dick Clark, also is the majority shareholder of, I believe, majority of A24, and I think the larger shareholder in the Los Angeles Dodgers, among a bunch of other things. He also owns the hotel where the Golden Globes takes place, the Beverly Hilton Hotel. Jay Penske, the other half of it, owns all of the newspapers that cover the awards race. He bought all the existing trade publications, which are basically Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Deadline, and to some extent IndieWire. Mm-hmm. When you say that the critics have been. The reviews have been positive on the Golden Globes. Well, most of those reviewers work for the owner of the Golden Globes. These publications also survive almost entirely on for-your consideration advertising, something that the Enkler takes as well. But when you have a process for the number two awards show, they also own this. The process is very opaque about the voting and the membership and everything else. And the people who control that are coming to you every 5 minutes and say, hey, we got a new dinner that you should support. We have a new ad campaign. Here's a new chance to up your for your consideration money. And the people who write about that and cover it work for you. It's this kind of unbelievable. It is like, The Washington Post bought the Democratic and Republican parties also, and said we will hire them all. So it's the only parallel I can think of.
Katie, what are your thoughts on this? Because I know it does look. I look at this and I just laugh because it's like, well, this is insane. It's also what we have, and I will stand up for the critics, and I will say that we are an honest lot. We are very rarely swayed by the machinations of, you know, the studios, more or less. We're pretty
You're
good
also
about
human.
This.
I don't know. Like, if a studio wants to tell you that Wicked is a huge deal and worth considering and made a bunch of money, it's going to put it in your brain more than it might have been if it weren't for that massive marketing campaign. You know, like, we all get our screeners and put something at the top of the pile of things we're going to watch based on, you know, when it got mailed out, or, you know, sometimes they're going to send you a piece of swag that you didn't ask for and you think, oh, you know what? I finally need to watch Amelia Perez. So, you know, yeah. Everyone's a human being in this flawed process, and all awards are made up. It's all invented by human beings to give awards to other human beings. Sorry, I cut you off in the middle of that.
No, that is, I mean, that's the other thing, right? Is that this is at a certain point, even the Oscars themselves, it's all made up. It's all, you know, this is a thing that, you know, kind of exists in its own little universe anyway. So why not?
When you start talking about what's a real awards show, you get into silliness pretty quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Richard that Penske owning as much of the Hollywood apparatus as he does, as this company does, is a problem. It creates a ton of self-dealing. It creates a ton of echo chambers. It makes it hard for something like the Ankler to kind of break in, or anyone to say, like, hey, look, I can't believe these guys are doing this. Like, I think the Globes are inherently flawed. I think they're better than they used to be, aside from the fact of the ownership. And, you know, Richard's been investigating the ways that, like, it might not even be legal and they might need to go back and start all over again. Yeah. But I do believe in award shows in general. I think this whole March of Precursor Awards that we have benefits movies being seen. It benefits studios wanting to invest in making these movies in the first place. It allows people to feel celebrated in some way. You know, to go back to Sebastian Stan, like, his genuine gratitude for winning a Golden Globe. Like, we can stand here all we want and say, like, these awards are kind of silly. They're voted on by a bunch of anonymous people. But, you know, for actors who need validation, we all know the stories about how actors work. Like, that's a real feeling to stand up on a stage in front of your peers and people you respect and feel celebrated in that moment. And I'm grateful for that. I like award season because of all of that. And again, like, the Golden Globes might not be my first pick for the one that we, like, put on the biggest platform, but that's what we've got right now. And I don't want to get rid of them entirely. I think they serve too much of a purpose.
Yeah. And I do think, feeling celebrated is great, but I do think that the importance of this is that it does encourage more casual film fans to say, oh, The Brutalist is nominated for all of these. What is The Brutalist? I don't even know what that is. What should I go see that? Is that, should I go see this 3.5-hour drama about an immigrant architect? I don't know. Maybe I should go see that.
Yeah.
And that is not a thing that they would think without absent this whole rigmarole.
Yeah.
And I that's positive. That is objectively a good thing.
Yeah. And you get movies like The Brutalist, which is kind of just rolling out in theaters. I don't think it's playing in most places yet. Or Hard Truth with Marion Jean-Baptiste, who's won a bunch of critics awards. That's only now opening this weekend. Or I'm Still Here, which Fernando Torres won the Golden Globe for. Like, these movies are launching now because of all of this stuff. It is an engine to create interest in them.
Anything that's promoting movies and promoting you're watching movies is on some level a good thing. You know, if there's questions about the why they're doing it and how they're doing it, then you wonder how much it infects the entire ecosystem there. But
that's and that's why the work that you're doing, Richard, I think is really valuable. Like, we can
thank you very much.
Be glad that the Golden Globes chose someone good, but it doesn't mean you can't ask questions about how this is all working and who it's impacting.
Questions are still coming.
Yeah. Keep working. I'm not. Again, yeah. I'm never getting invited to the Golden Globes as long as you keep at it. So I think you'll never run out of things to dig into there, I don't think.
The sad thing is it was the most fun show to go to also. So that's my
defend New York Film Critics Circle Dinner, which I didn't get to this week because it was right after the Golden Globes, which is not on television. And everyone knows the winners in advance. So no one is nervous and no one has to act right for TV cameras. That's the most fun one to me.
Yeah, that is a fun show. I always like following along the New York Film Critics Circle on distance over Twitter, you know,
to
see what folks are up to. So, Katie, you mentioned that some of the other precursor awards have been delayed or canceled. What's the state of the schedule of the awards season and show lineup right now? Because again, everything in Los Angeles is in chaos. Everything's in flux. Like, what are people going to do?
Yeah, I'm going to try and see if I can get all of the things that are delayed correct, because there's been a lot of them. I mean, you had the Critics' Choice Awards were supposed to air this Sunday, or when this comes out, Sunday, January 12th. They've been postponed 2 weeks. Now they're happening in the middle of Sundance and well after the Oscar nominations are announced. So who knows what that's going to do for turnout for that one. The SAG Awards announced their nominations on Wednesday, and usually I'd be getting this flood of, like, I'm so grateful to Screen Actors Guild for nominating me, like, and none of that happened. Like, everyone just kind of very quietly except for their nomination. The Producers Guild were going to announce their nominees, and Writers Guild, I think, but they all got pushed until next week. And then there was just all these events, you know, the AFI luncheon, the BAFTA tea, FYC screenings, premieres, all this stuff that would normally be happening in LA and in New York. There's some in New York stuff that got canceled as well. So you've got some people who are willing to do press. Like, as we're speaking, I just talked to Robert Eggers, the director of Nosferatu, who lives in London. You know, he's distanced from all this. But mm-hmm. I think everyone just feels like it's not the right time to promote yourself, which I think is correct. Yeah. I think anyone who's complaining, I would imagine everyone in the Oscar race is thinking like, oh, man, this is really going to distract from my FYC campaign. But they won't say it out loud wisely. So it's something everyone just kind of has to suck up. And the Oscar nominations voting period got delayed 2 days. It's going to end on Tuesday instead of Sunday. And so technically everyone's got more time to get their pushes out there. But more or less, the whole like phase one of campaigning ended a week early. And now everyone just kind of has to sit with it.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Yeah, one thing I saw some folks talking about, I'm curious to get your take on this because I have no idea if it's true or not, is that the combination of the, you know, fire out in L.A. and everybody being in flux and the kind of softer reminders that this is going on will lead to a less robust domestic vote turn. You know, in politics, we always talk about turnout, right? Turnout is everything. Turnout is the thing that matters most. Are you getting urban turnout, rural turnout? What is a turnout? In the Oscar race, there's I think, a fairly well defined split between what, you know, kind of older domestic audiences are voting for versus younger, more international or older domestic Academy voters versus younger, more international Academy voters. Is there any discussion of that kind of changing the course of the race? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just impossible to know, right? It's all speculation about, like, you know, if you've evacuated from your home, are you going to log on to the website to file your Oscar ballot? Probably not. But also there's a ton of Academy members who are based around the world, like you said. So, like, does that mean that the Oscar nominations more closely resemble the European Film Awards, where Emilia Perez did really well? We're only ever going to be able to theorize about it. As much as I would love for the Academy to release voting data, they never will. So we won't have the info, like, precinct by precinct the way we would for a real election. So, yeah, I'm going to be writing about it for next week, about, like, how this might shift things. And it's hard to know, but I think it's a pretty decent theory that LA turnout, like you said, will be down from what we usually see.
Yeah, no, that is crazy. The other thing, Richard, I've seen some people suggest. Gene Smart, for instance, was out there saying we got to cancel award season. We got to stop this. Let's spend that money on rebuilding Hollywood. And I understand that. I understand that impulse. But it does feel like this is, you know, the show itself could be an opportunity for fundraising, for, you know, getting awareness out, like something along those lines, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think most people, certainly by a week from now, let alone from 2 months from now, will be grateful for a few minutes to think about something else and do something else. And, you know, it's canceling the awards. There's a lot of people it's one thing to say, oh, that who cares about the stars getting on the prize? But there's thousands of people whose jobs are producing those awards, who you'd be putting out of work if you cancel that at a time when so many people are out of work and everything already. So that's that's a suggestion that is not quite taking into account the full scope of what this awards industrial complex represents.
Yeah, I mean, when you're in LA on these awards weekends, like for the Golden Globes, I mean, it's not just the people working the Golden Globes themselves, it's the people working at the Netflix party as coat check or waiters or videographers on the red carpet outside. Or when we have our events, we have a video crew that's hired to take the video of it. And every publication does the same thing. Like the Uber drivers get more fares because there's more people in town. Like the effects are so huge. And I was thinking about this too on kind of this like morale propaganda level, like when the Sunset Fire started and the evacuation zone extended to Hollywood Boulevard, and you're thinking of the Dolby Theater. The reason that I know where the Dolby Theater is, where, you know, what that is because of the Oscars. Like there is a propaganda effect for the entire city of Los Angeles for this awards stuff. And that's, you know, it's high and mighty. Like there's obviously bigger work to be done, but I think it's just a huge opportunity to put a spotlight on the city when it's safe to have these events. It's just going to need it. You need people to be looking toward Los Angeles as long as possible.
Fire's not going to still be burning in March, you know.
God, geez, Richard, don't say things like that.
I mean, you know, a week from
God
now.
God willing.
A week from now, the fires will either be mostly done or the city will be gone. So it's like, it will go one way or another. So it's, this isn't like COVID that just lingers for years. It's,
you're allowed to have gallows humor. We're not, if we're not in LA. Yeah. So get away
with
it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Believe me, like even this half hour here, it's a welcome, opportunity to think about something else, besides, we're going through. So I think most people are happy to have that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, then let's talk about the Oscars. First, let's talk about Ankler Pundits, because I have always been a fan of watching, you know, the predictions as they come out. And I'm very excited to have been asked to participate. This is very neat for me. Katie, explain to folks who have no idea what I'm talking about what exactly it is we're discussing now.
Well, this is really Richard's brainchild, so I want to let him talk about it mostly. Okay. But more or less, if you go to anklerpundits.com, you can see your predictions, my predictions, Richard's, many other smart people who we like and respect across the internet, and just saying who we think is going to get nominated in all these categories. And then once the nominations are out on January 19th, we'll switch it to who we think is going to win in all these categories. So if you want, you know, everyone's got their own predictions, and personally, I'm usually terrible at actually predicting who's going to win Oscars, but the aggregate of it, I think, is very valuable. If you see that everyone is saying this thing, sometimes everyone can be wrong, but it gives you a really good sense of taking the temperature of where the race stands. Richard, what do you want to add?
Yeah, Richard,
yeah, I mean,
yeah.
No,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, again, we get back to Penske Media, owner of the Golden Globes. They have a site called Gold Derby, which has had a pundit chart, but is mostly open to only members of Penske Media. So we wanted to start a alternative poll to it, because there are a lot of very smart people, including yourself, who are not part of it. So I think we have a really impressive group that all of whom have really interesting things to say. And you can track it, and people update their predictions, and you can see what's moving up and down the charts as we go.
This does have, there is a long and storied tradition of internet pundits doing this sort of thing. I do feel like this is like there's a whole book to be written about the Oscar industrial complex and the Oscar bloggers and, you know, and all that sort of thing. My question, I guess, is, it's a chicken and an egg thing. Do you think that the predictions shape the race, or are the predictions just a function of how the race is going? Right? Does that question make sense? Is it?
Oh yeah.
Are the predictors themselves? It's Heisenberg's principle. Once you interact with a thing, it changes it. And I do think that does kind of apply here on one level.
I mean, what's always fascinating to me is that sort of when you look at the professional pundits, the worst of them kind of get 70% right on Oscar night. So it's that you do have this sense that Oscar is sort of endorsing the consensus that is formed out there elsewhere.
Well, but it's also a consensus vote, right? Like you need 5,000 or so people, to a majority of them, to vote for your movie. So consensus is kind of baked into how the process works.
And it's ranked voting.
Yeah.
Which means that if you if a lot of people put you in last place, that's a vote against you. So you need to be a film that very few people put in last place.
Yeah, for best picture.
Even if you don't get the most number one votes.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that only for Best Picture, right?
Oh, God, I'm going to say this and I'm going to be wrong. When I was in L.A., I was talking to a guy who worked for a long time, making the rules for all the different branches of the Academy, and I said something to him. He was like, actually, that's not how it works. And anyway, it's very hard to remember. I know that ranked choice works for picking Best Picture. That's a really important part of it. So you need to have, if you're in number one, but you don't have a 50% thing, they then go to number two on your ballot and so on and so forth. But I honestly am not going to be able to tell you which other categories it applies to, because the Academy, in all its fascination, different branches do it different ways, and there's a lot of rules to keep track of.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. I did not realize that for the other categories.
I think. Oh God, please don't let me be wrong.
Okay. I'm not even jumping in here.
Even in, like, you know, they have the short list that come out in December for 10 different categories. Right. You know, production design has a short list, but costumes don't. And have one.
Some of the branches let people from outside of their branch opt in and vote towards the short list in their branch, and some don't.
Yeah.
So what are you thinking of the state of the race right now, Katie? What is your gut say about the leading contenders for Best Picture?
I think whatever wins Best Picture is going to do it by a slim margin, because it is a year where there is no real consensus favorite anything, and that has time to change. The SAG Awards sometimes are something that can change it. We know where Parasite won Best Ensemble at the SAG Awards in 2020, and that kind of vaulted it to the front of the race kind of at the last minute. So by the time we get to the Oscars, it could be really clear. But, you know, Emilia Perez and The Brutalist winning the top Golden Globes, I think everyone thought those two were right there in the mix. Then The Brutalist doesn't get a Best Ensemble SAG nomination, and SAG, the actors are the biggest voting branch in the Academy. So is it not as popular with them? Who knows? Anora is the Palme d'Or winner, but it's been kind of failing to get traction outside of some of these smaller critics groups. So what does it have the ability to kind of break through with there? Conclave is really well liked. It's kind of something you can easily imagine being, you know, back to that preferential ballot, like number two and number three in a lot of people's ballots. Is that how you win Best Picture? Could be. And then A Complete Unknown, I think, would round out the five of what I'd see at the top of the mix. I still think Timothée Chalamet is going to win Best Actor, even though Adrien Brody won at the Golden Globes. And so does that movie have enough beyond him to kind of vault into Best Picture? I think to be a Best Picture winner, you kind of need to be about something these days. It needs to be not a social issue, but about family, about immigration, about overcoming differences. You know, there's always some larger thing at work, even if Oppenheimer was about a lot of things. I think it won Best Picture because it was about a studio movie being really good and doing really well. It's unclear what any of them have. Like, Emilia Perez is kind of the closest to having like a message to it, but it's also strange and very French, and who knows how that's going to go. So yeah, it's kind of a really split, wide open race. I feel more confident on the acting races than I did before the Golden Globes, but a lot of other stuff is still really fuzzy.
Yeah, Richard, even before you had seen A Complete Unknown, you had tweeted something to me that is number one favorite for me. I think that is do you still feel that way?
Yes, but I feel I would put maybe less money on it than I would. I think that group that Katie mentioned, I could see. And any of them could win. And I think that, you know, it's like a presidential primary. Like, the narrative has to change. Like, people get sick of saying the same thing all the time. So I think something is going to come out and surge. And nothing's real. You've got that pack of films that Katie mentioned. And something is kind of going to break out of there and get people excited. I would say, just like if you were a statistician, based on the nominations last week and everything, I'd feel pretty good for A Complete Unknown, but you know, Wicked is also the kind of big blockbuster crowd pleaser that a lot of people really, really like and have really emotional reactions to it. I've noticed sort of a gender divide in reactions to Complete Unknown, which
Can't imagine why. Nothing in the text of the movie would make it women respond to it differently.
I don't know what movie women are seeing here, but if what I've seen is true, that won't serve Complete Unknown well. So
yeah,
if you become a divisive film and there's people voting against you and putting you in last place, you know, so your last place vote will cancel out a first place vote. So
yeah. Well, this is one of the things I find Emilia Perez to be fascinating as an award season contender, because I remember watching it and thinking, Netflix is insane. Netflix is insane for making this their award season standard bearer. I don't understand what they're doing, and I have clearly been very wrong so far. I have been totally incorrect about that, which is, again, you mentioned you can't have a divisive movie. You can't have somebody voting against you. And I do see, and who knows if this is just a very online thing because I spend all my time on social media like an idiot or what. But like, I see a lot of people who are very anti Emilia Perez in a way that is in a way that I do not see with any of the other movies, you know, for either politics reasons or, you know, representation, whatever. I have seen more anti-Emilia Perez takes than I have for any other movie, which is kind of interesting.
I also just realized, I was going to throw in a counterpoint of Wicked, I forgot to mention Wicked in the top five that I mentioned. So make it a top six, because I think Wicked is in there. It feels like a distraction, but when I think of Emilia Perez winning all the awards and Wicked being right there, they do kind of go side by side in my head.
Yeah.
The Emilia Perez detractors, they sort of come from both sides, too. There's people saying, oh, I can't believe you're doing a positive movie about a Mexican drug lord. And there's people who say, oh, it's a cliched rendition of the transsexual experience. So
right. Well, this is it. Right. You hear both. I hear from both my friends on the left who are like, this is an anti-trans movie. Then I hear from my friends on the right, this is a pro-trans movie. This is and they're like, it's weird. And I can't tell if it's going to cancel each other out or if it, you know, if it's just noise in the ether. I also think. Part of me wonders what an Oscar campaign in like the early 2000s with this movie looks like, because the takes, the ad campaigns, the like leaks, the ugliness would be off the charts.
It doesn't feel
else.
Like the Emilia Perez takes are everywhere, but it doesn't feel like they have taken hold the way that like Harvey Weinstein could have made everyone suddenly think that it was important what John Nash's real background was. You know, there's the media landscape is so fractured and like chaotic and distracted by other things at this point, which is really maybe working in their favor, honestly. Like, I think the thing about Emilia Perez that the reason it's going so far as it has is that it's more accessible than it kind of seems from the outside. Like, it's played really well at some of these regional film festivals in like Middleburg, Virginia, or the Hamptons with like pretty middle of the road, like wealthy older people, because it's kind of a melodrama, you know, it's about these very relatable feelings and family and, you know, people sing their thoughts, and anyone who likes a musical, like, I don't love the music in this movie, but like, I think you can kind of wrap your head around it way more than you can with The Brutalist, honestly. It's a lot less challenging than that, even though The Brutalist is like a, you know, familiar American epic kind of format, but I think more challenging in its way it's made and in its ideas than Emilia Perez is.
I would say so the just to get to the very, very most simple rule that I look to, where it's back in the 80s and 90s, it used to be the film with the most outdoor daytime exteriors will win Best Picture. So you look at Braveheart and Gandhi and all these
Titanic.
English Patient, all these movies, big outdoor daytime exteriors. The a pundit said to me, and I think it's the most true thing I heard, Oscar wants films that take you on a journey. And I just always come back to, does this film feel like it's taking you on a journey? And I think if you look back at all the movies from Moonlight to King's Speech or whatever you have, they all sort of took you on a journey. At the end, and there's a there's an ending to it that feels like a real crescendo. Everything. Oppenheimer certainly took you on a journey. With that, I think, and I think Emilia Perez did that. I feel like you, it kind of carried you along, and a lot big things happen, but I think if I look at what film does that the most, I'm probably Wicked is where you end up.
Yeah. Although I would make a case for Conclave being a deceptively good contender there, because it takes you, like, it gets you so surprisingly invested in the process of electing this new pope. Like, you really, someone like posted about this, like, you know, before starting Conclave, you think, I don't really care about the pope. And then an hour in, you're like, for the sake of the church, Tedesco cannot be pope. So that's a journey in its own way. And honestly, I've been thinking about Conclave about, you know, in the spoiler alert, I guess, they're like interrupted by this explosion, kind of this giant destructive event that makes them rethink the process, and it seems awfully similar to some of what we're going through right now, so who knows, maybe that gives it a boost.
Yeah, I still think when we were discussing this, Richard, I said that my 1 and 1A at the time were Conclave and Wicked, because they definitely felt like the most I don't know. They just felt like the most obvious choices. And now I don't know. I think it's very, very up in the air. I think it's pretty wide open in a way I have not thought of a race, certainly for Best Picture, for a while. So.
And we like that. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Like Richard's, you know, talking about these precursor awards, it's like you see Christopher Nolan give the same, you know, variation of the same speech 5 times, you get a little exhausted. And I don't think that's going to happen this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did. I wrote a column about awards show back in the year of Brokeback Mountain. I went to 17 awards shows, and I got to see that team give the speech 17 times over and over, and
they still didn't win Best Picture.
And because they had given it 17 times over and over, the Oscar voters said, we can't hear them make the speech again. So let's give it to Crash.
Yeah. All right, Katie, you said you wanted to critique my picks on the thing. You don't have to. You don't have to tear down my confidence here. You know that's totally optional.
You picked a great headshot.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for uploading your photo.
Many kudos to Hannah Yost here at the Bulwark for that. She did all of our headshots. She's the best.
I think you're crazy for thinking that Guy Pearce is in the top position for Best Supporting Actor. I think Kieran Culkin has got that one in a walk. That's the critique I'll throw your way.
Oh, yeah. You know, I thought I had updated that. Maybe I didn't.
Okay, fine. You're backing down. I love your pick of Dennis Quaid in that category, though. What a fun prediction.
See, I liked it. Well, no, it's definitely not going to be him. Obviously, that is not going to happen. But I did think he's great in The Substance.
He is.
He is. The sound work on his chewing should have gotten The Substance all the music and audio nominations, which I don't think it did. I think it got shut out of the audio.
Did it get shut out of the shortlist category for sound? I know it didn't make it for visual effects, which I was also hoping it would make.
Yeah. Too bad. No, that's definitely. Should I be updating this as we as
yes,
we, or should
please.
I? Okay, I wasn't sure if I had to leave things as they were once I had filed my initial picks.
No. It's real time reflecting the.
Richard, I'm going to give you a hard time. You haven't done anything except Best Picture yet, so you got to get on it.
No, I don't. I don't have firm feelings beyond Best Picture. You're independent. I have no idea.
This whole thing was your idea, and you're going to cop out of the rest of the category.
It was, but I wasn't thinking about. I was delighted to see what pundits like yourself, who pay close attention to this, think about these categories. But beyond Best Picture, I leave it to the field.
Wow.
Okay. Richard, as you know, I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If there's anything that folks should know or be aware of.
You didn't ask about what are my favorite moments from attending the Globes, which.
Yes, in all of your times attending the Globes, what were your favorites?
A pleasure I will never know. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. What Katie, give your taste of what you'll never experience. There are many many memories I treasure. Two that stick with me. One was riding an elevator with Donald Trump and Brian Grazier, comparing where they're comparing very competitively where their stars are on the Walk of Fame, and who had a better position there. So that was a fun night. And I remember the night that Mel Gibson was there. Jodie Foster brought him in to give her an award, and he was sort of kind of being ignored and sort of by the room. And I was walking up these little stairs, and he was walking down, and it was sort of in a crush of people, and we were sort of shoved together face to face, and it was a very awkward and with a crush of people around it, all ignoring him. And I looked up and said, "Oh, I'm being shoved into the chest of Mel Gibson." And I said, "Good to see you, Mr. Gibson." And he said, "Yeah, you too."
Fair enough.
Relatively polite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he didn't shove you down the stairs, so that's good. Yeah. All right. Those are
my two strongest memories of many years ago.
All right. And again, for folks, I'm going to have some links to people taking donations to help with the recovery out in Los Angeles. So I hope folks check those out as well. It is still pretty dicey, and I hope everything gets under control here in the next few days for all my friends out there, including you, Richard, including you. Especially you. Number one guest. First and possibly last guest.
First, yeah. We'll see if anyone takes that from me next week.
All right. Katie, thank you for being on the show for the first time.
Oh, my God. Thank you for having me.
It was great. Again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.